Hey, if you're enjoying this show, consider supporting us on our Patreon. You can get cool perks like access to these episodes a week before they go public, and you can pick an album for us to review. Any support is greatly appreciated, so if you feel inclined, go to patreon.com/polyphonicpress.
You're listening to Polyphonic Press, a podcast for music lovers. Join your hosts, Jeremy Boyd and John Van Dyke, as they take a deep dive into a classic album and analyze it track by track.
Hi, welcome to Polyphonic Press. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
And I'm John Van Dyke.
And basically, if you don't know how this show works, we review albums and we have no idea what album is going to come up. So let's go ahead and hit the button and see what album we're going to be listening to this week. All right, so here we go. The album we're going to be listening to this week is Alice Cooper's Love It to Death. I don't know this album.
I'm guessing it's from the 70s.
I would imagine so. 1971. Okay, oh. So this is Love It to Death. So, Love It to Death is the third studio album by American rock group Alice Cooper. So, that's an interesting thing. Alice Cooper was the name of the band.
Yeah.
Before Alice Cooper took over and became Alice Cooper. Like the guy Alice Cooper.
Yeah.
So he, I think he was like, I think he's, it's, it gets confusing. He's in the band, but the band is also called Alice Cooper.
Well, his,
if that makes sense. But like the name of the band was Alice Cooper.
Right. But what was his name before?
I don't know. I think he went by Alice Cooper, but it was also the name of the band.
Fine.
I gets confusing. But anyway, so it's the third studio album produced by Bob Ezrin, who is became a very famous rock producer. He produced Destroyer by Kiss, and he produced The Wall by Pink Floyd, and a whole bunch of stuff. But this was when he was relatively unknown. He made his name by producing Alice Cooper. He's a Canadian producer, and I think this might have been recorded in... No, it was recorded in Chicago. So Alice Cooper's real name is Vincent Furnier. Which is a less cool name than Alice Cooper, I think. Co-formed the Earwigs. So this is the background on him. So the singles, the big single from this album is I'm 18, which is probably one of his best known songs. I think this was the album that really kind of broke through for them.
Yeah.
Reading. So Love It to Death is seen as one of the foundational albums of the heavy metal sound, along with contemporary releases by Black Sabbath, Led Zeppelin, Deep Purple, and others. A review by in a British magazine Melody Maker called it an album for the punk and pimply crowd. A few years before punk rock became a phenomenon, pioneer punk band The Ramones found inspiration in Alice Cooper's music and Love It to Death in particular. Interesting.
I think so, you could also say it, you know, there's elements of glam too.
Oh, for sure. Like, yeah. I think Alice Cooper was one of, if not the first, people in rock to really make a big production out of a concert. I know Kiss kind of was a few years after, I think, but, Alice Cooper really took it to, you know, having like sight gags and really made it more of a show rather than just, you know, playing music, which is kind of cool. All right, so let's get into the album. The first song on the album is called Caught in a Dream. So let's hear it. I'm caught in a dream. So what? You don't know what I'm going through. I'm right in between. So I'll just play along with you. So that one definitely had some glam elements in there, which I was... I don't know. I always saw glam rock is more of a British thing.
Well, you know, it wasn't strictly a British thing. I mean, the New York Dolls are.
That's true.
New York, so you know.
Yeah.
No, I was gonna go back to when you were mentioning visual gags and stuff, and I'm thinking, you know, visual gags, I mean, they've been around for a little while before this, too. I mean, Jim that my dad played with, Jim Wehner, back in the Tombstone days in the 60s, they would bring him out in a coffin, you know, and then he would start singing as soon as they opened the coffin.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, no, they were definitely around, but I think what Alice Cooper did with it was made it like the whole show was that.
Yeah, I guess.
Kind of thing, okay. You know? He made it more of a, he always says he made it more of a, like a vaudeville act than a music thing.
Gotcha.
With the, you know, the guillotine and the snakes and all that kind of stuff. All those. He actually, do you know who James Randi is?
I don't think so.
He's a magician.
Okay.
Who he influenced like a whole bunch of people. He's a skeptic. You know, debunking like, you know, mediums and people taking advantage of, you know, people like that and, you know, talking to the dead kind of stuff. But he was also known as a musician, and he actually helped Alice Cooper put together his show.
Okay.
Which is pretty cool.
So yeah, he's making sure no one actually loses their head with the guillotine.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause you know, nobody likes a lawsuit.
Nope.
And I think this is the album where that kind of started. That big show, I think, or at least they had the, I think the idea, and, you know, it's funny, Alice Cooper always talks about how all the parents of the kids really, you know, didn't like, they were scared by Alice Cooper and thought he was like a devil worshiper and all that. You know, kind of panic that parents had in the 70s. And it's funny, it's because it was like a vaudeville kind of thing, all the old like comedians and stuff would go to the show, like George Burns and you know, the Marx Brothers. They all loved Alice Cooper because he was like kind of bringing that kind of style back. And but wrapping it up in this like spooky kind of thing, but which scared the parents. It was funny. It's like,
yeah, well,
but the people that the entertainers that the parents were into Alice Cooper.
Yes, exactly.
So I thought that was funny.
It honestly works that way. Like, that was honestly not that uncommon. I mean, when the Who were on the Smothers Brothers and they blew up the set, basically, you know who was cheering them on? Mickey Rooney.
Oh, yeah.
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 He thought it was great.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, I think entertainers, at least the old school entertainers, they saw the value of putting on a great show, and you know, they all got it. They all knew what the business was, and they knew that it was, you know, it wasn't anything to be afraid of, or it wasn't devil worshiping. It was just a show, you know?
Right?
You know, that's just all it is. But Yeah, I just thought it was funny that the parents were scared, but the, you know, the entertainers that the parents were into loved all that stuff. So
yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm for as far as the song goes, nothing. I like the two guitar solos. I think the two guitar players trading off solos was kind of cool at the end there. Mm-hmm. Other than that, it was. I wouldn't say it was a basic rock song, but it was just, you know, it was.
It definitely had that glam sort of production quality to it.
Yeah.
The vocals had sort of a what would you call that on it?
It's not like a delay, but it's like double tracked vocals, maybe.
Might be like a double track. I'm thinking if it's a reverb, it's like the reverb's turned way down though.
Yeah, so like it's that. Like really dry.
It's not dry. It's just.
It has some presence to it, yeah. But it's not overpowered with reverb. Yeah. Yeah. Room tone, I guess. Yeah. Yeah, I kind of know what you mean. I wasn't really paying too much attention to the vocals, honestly, so I wasn't really hearing that, but
well, we'll hear it.
We'll hear it again, hopefully. Anyway, the next song is a song that I know, I'm sure you do too, and it's probably one of the biggest hits that Alice Cooper had. It's a song called I'm 18. So one of the things that immediately stood out to me there that I never really noticed before, but it's obvious now, is how clean the guitars sound.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's almost no distortion on them. And the distortion really is coming from Alice Cooper's voice.
Yeah. No, actually, it's true. You go back to, the 60s and 70s, and where you think, well, that's where all the distorted guitar, and it was, but there were still a lot of clean tones, even in, mm-hmm. like, you know, some of the harder songs at the time. I mean, not everybody had to have their guitar sound like a buzzsaw, much right. like, you know, that you would hear, and certainly metal coming along, and mm-hmm. then again in garage or something like that. And,
yeah.
Not necessarily that I dislike that. I don't dislike it, but it's nice to mix it up sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, I just think it's interesting that like this is seen as like a big like hard rock song.
Yeah.
And but the guitars are basically just they're great guitars and they sound great and
they sound
fit the record perfectly, but it's just like, oh, maybe they are perfect because I didn't notice it, but it's just like, oh, I never, you know, the guitars are pretty.
There might be like a touch of overdrive on it just to give it a little bit more meat on it. But for the most part, yeah, it's very clean and clear. And,
mm-hmm. And even when he was singing, there's even a chorus effect on the guitars.
Yeah.
Just, you know, as he's singing the verses, there's the chorus and then, you know, it goes to the chorus.
Right.
You know.
The chorus, that's a sound you more associate with, like, the 1980s in mm-hmm. a lot of cases. But, yeah, it was around.
I don't think chorus... Were chorus pedals around at this point, or were they doing that in the studio?
It makes the guitar sound like a double tracked or something like that.
Yeah,
that must be what I heard on the vocals. It almost sounded like a chorus on the vocals.
Could
or something
be
like that.
Yeah,
so, the very glam sound.
Yeah,
this song didn't have that, but
no.
The last one certainly did.
Yeah, because I know. Before there was chorus pedals for guitars, I know that they would do it in the studio, and it's basically what chorus is. It's a very fast delay with a frequency sweep on the delay signal.
Mm.
So it sounds like the guitar is slightly out of tune, but it sounds like two guitars that are playing together rather than one.
Yeah.
So that's how the chorus effect is. It's same with flange. Flange is very similar to chorus.
But flange has got, it's got more of a tone adjustment on it, whereas chorus is basically straight up what you're putting in is what it's replicating.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. And I'm certain now that that's what they put on the vocals.
Yeah.
Especially on things like Rocky Horror Picture Show, and you would hear it in like Meatloaf or stuff like that.
Yeah.
And of course, lots of glam rock.
Mm-hmm.
I think David Bowie used it occasionally. He didn't always use it. I'm trying to think who else. Yeah. Anyway, you get my idea.
Yeah. 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 No. It does give the vocals a very glamorous feel,
you know? Yeah,
that shiny, exactly. Yeah. yeah that's yeah, and it was
it
overused
like
the in
the glitter
80s.
On their faces.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. The other thing I noticed about this song too is the harmonica. I never really noticed that either, but that was thrown in there too. Which I thought that was pretty interesting. Lyrically, the song, it's kind of...
It's rudimentary, but then again, it's... a lot of songs like that, and if you think about it, like stage productions, I mean, they're not trying to like confuse the audience. Everything is very straightforward. Mm-hmm. So it fits that. So if he's doing like a stage show, he wants his music to sort of come across.
Yeah. But you have to put it in the context of 1971 too. I mean, now singing about, you know, the indulgence of youth, I guess, is cliche, but it really wasn't then. No. Maybe a little bit, but not.
Well, it definitely started, like, that's another thing that they did a lot in the 60s. You know, actually, they kind of did it in the 50s, if you think about some of like the rockabilly stuff, little bit.
Yeah.
If they were specific about teenagers, I don't know about that, but maybe occasionally. But yeah, it would definitely be more of an underground thing. It's not the sort of stuff they would necessarily find on the radio. So that's probably what was new.
Yeah.
Is it hit the radio as a hit.
Yeah. I don't remember where I saw it. It sounds really like neckbeardy now. I think it was an interview with Bob Ezrin, the producer, and he was saying how when he was first presented the song, he thought Alice Cooper was singing "I'm Edgy." But you know, a guy singing, when the vision of a guy singing "I'm Edgy," you get a guy who's like an incel on Reddit or something.
Yeah, he's an edgelord.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm so hardcore. Yeah. I can beat up your dad.
Yeah. 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 But he thought that was cool because no one had ever sung anything like that before. It's like, I'm edgy and I like it, you know. Which I think that would be a cool punk rock song, you know.
Singing about being edgy.
Yeah.
It would have to be somewhat tongue-in-cheek because, like you said, it's very...
It's now it is. I don't think, you know, the 70s it wouldn't have been, but I think now it would be. It's
yeah.
Yeah.
I could still see it coming out, but you would definitely have to not take it overly seriously because you get mocked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, the next song is called "Long Way to Go." So let's get into that.
We still got a long way to go.
Okay, there was a lot going on there.
Mm-hmm.
It started off as more, it really was kind of a punk rock song.
Yeah.
And then the guitar solo, I like the music kind of dropped out, and it was just the one guitar was just doing like muted strums while the guitar solo was happening, and then it went into like the bluesy thing with the piano.
Well, it's a very like early rock and roll sort of thing, but a lot of like again, that's what sort of what punk was, punk going or rock and roll going back to its roots, and so a lot of punk actually has a lot of overlap with like say a lot of 50s rock and roll, and you can hear it in like glam and stuff like that. Yeah, again, think of you know, Meatloaf and Rocky Horror Picture Show. The songs are very almost like written in the 1950s,
yeah,
kind of way.
Yeah.
And yeah, this song's no different. It's very definitely like a 50s rocker. It's almost like a what would I think about? It's like a Gene Vincent thing, or almost, or
yeah.
Or Little like Richard or something like that.
Little Richard, yeah, definitely has that energy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I definitely, but with the hard guitars and the, the, I can see like the Sex Pistols or something doing this song.
Right.
As well.
The Sex Pistols, yeah, maybe the Sex Pistols, they're a little bit,
Or maybe not the Sex Pistols, but like a British punk band I can see taking this song on.
Maybe, take that on. I'm trying to think of which British band would take that on. It definitely sounds more like a sort of the New York Detroit sort of thing in my ears.
Yeah.
I'm not saying there wouldn't be a British punk band that would come along and do it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there might have been, just not one we've ever heard of.
yeah. True. Very true.
Remember, there's scenes of bands and we only really get to hear about top echelons of them.
But I think so far this might be my favorite song.
It's pretty good.
Just because there are like, I felt like it was getting a little, it's hard to say because it was getting a little boring. I know it's only a 3-minute song, but it was starting to get repetitive. And then they came in with that guitar solo, you know, like with where the music dropped out and they had the other guitar doing the muted strums. And I thought, okay, that is interesting. And then it kind of slowed down a bit and was doing that bluesy thing with the piano. It's like, oh, okay, this is totally like, you know, different from how it started.
Yeah.
And, so I thought that was really cool. So it became, I think because of that, it's so far my favorite one on the album.
Yeah. It's a cool song.
Yeah. But, anyway, let's get into the next one. It's called Black Juju. This is a long one. This is 9 minutes and 11 seconds.
Oh, the black ones are the licorice flavored ones.
Yeah.
They never as good as real licorice. But then, anyway, I know. That's a digression.
Here's Black Juju. Well, that was something.
Yeah. I actually really like that. I love stuff like that. So yeah. That's like, that one reminds me, and that's another artist I had sort of glossed over when we were talking about artists who'd put on like really theatrical shows. But this really sounded like Arthur Brown to me. It's got that sort of psych. Partly it's the organ that made me really think of it. Is that combo organ doing like a really dark theme sort of thing going on, and then I'm thinking Arthur Brown, and then as more as the song's going on, the more I'm thinking Arthur Brown. So yeah. I'm sure they're aware of him.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure Alice Cooper's mentioned him
as a major influence.
Yeah
That totally makes sense.
Yeah.
And, he's still going too, Arthur Brown.
One of the things that I picked up on as well is I think something that was influenced by this and Arthur Brown too was Nick Cave. There was some elements that he used, I think, was in here as well. yeah, there's just that that dark but also funny. Like it's done with a sense of humor. It's really dark, but it's also really funny at the same time.
It's sort of a right.
You
it's
know.
Like, that was awful. Isn't that hilarious?
Exactly. Yeah. I've always liked stuff like that, like Tom Waits, you know, it just that kind of like, when I think when people, you know, people kind of are off put off by stuff like that. And that's sort of a good barometer to whether it's going to be interesting or not, or whether I'm going to like it.
Sometimes.
If normal people are saying, oh, that's awful. I'm thinking, yeah, it's awful. You're right. It's awful.
Awful. Wink, wink. Awful.
You know, I don't know much what I can say about the song itself. I mean, it's interesting. I can't really, I'm going to have to hear it again. As far as there isn't really, well, I guess there is a structure to it, but it's not a conventional song structure.
Well, it starts off with those like African drum sort of thing going on. I mean, it's just the guy on the toms, but and the floor bass, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
But, or he's like really deadened one of his toms or something like that, and he's really pounding on it. But and then of course there's that high pitched organ that sort of comes in, which gives like sort of hints of almost like you know, the Transylvanian kind of thing going on in there. But it also just sounds very like a Farfisa playing behind drums. Actually, if you listen to a lot of Afrobeat, and it's mostly just because those combo organs are what they were able to, you know, scrounge up, but they're used a lot in Afrobeat and stuff like that. And they have this really interesting sound that sort of just blends with like the drums going on, and it's just really cool, actually. That's another branch of it does have like connections to rock and roll and stuff like that. It's pretty cool. I like Afrobeat. Yeah. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. I like the dynamics in this song as well. How it got like really quiet, almost to an uncomfortable level.
Yeah.
And I like that he knows that he's doing that.
Yeah, it's totally intentional. Well, this is the song I'm sure that they really would. This is the song where they probably brought out things like the guillotine, and so he could, you know, concentrate on, you know, not getting his head cut off instead of trying to sing or something like that. So this song is the stage performance song. So for sure,
yeah. That just remind this is totally off topic. Well, kind of, but well, I actually did see Alice Cooper a few years ago, and there's a song on the album Welcome to My Nightmare called Cold Ethel, and it's about necrophilia.
Yeah,
and
there's a few songs like that.
And but the show, he's like dancing with like basically a dead body, like a doll, a dead body for that song. And it's really, it was really funny the things he was doing with the doll. Cause it's like a stuffed doll. So it's all like flopping around.
Of course.
He's like dancing with it and it's got his head back and things like that.
Yeah. You know? I mean, the Headstones had a song that was very much about, digging up. Right.
And I think went there was down to my cemetery looking for love or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Had to dig her up, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know there was another obscure band. I don't remember what it was, but the song was called Janie's Tomb. And it's another one that's, they're out there.
Yeah.
And again, they're not meant to be taken seriously. If you take them seriously, you're not getting the point.
The line in Cold Ethel is, you're cool in bed. Well, she ought to be because Ethel's dead. Yeah. Anyway, speaking of dead bodies, the next song is called Is It My Body? So let's get into that. It's really up to you. Okay, cool. That one had a really cool groove to it.
Yeah.
I like that.
Quite short.
Yeah.
It didn't have to be very long. It's just a really great groove. Yeah, I love those bendy guitars. It sounds really cool.
One thing that I've always liked about Alice Cooper is his voice. And he's got that really gritty, like dirty rock and roll voice.
Yeah.
I always wonder how he sings like that, because when I try to do it, I always lose my voice and my throat hurts. I don't know how he does it for 2 hours in a show or something. But I've always liked that his voice, and I've always liked singers that sing like that. I don't like singers that sing really clean. I always like the...
It sort of depends.
Distorted, you know.
Some singers can really sing clean.
That's true, yeah.
Like your... Freddie Mercury's and
but even he had a little bit of grit to it.
Sometimes.
Like he had some, you know.
Yeah, he's got an interesting voice for sure, but he certainly knew how to use it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. It's sometimes a little bit of texture on a voice is really nice sometimes.
Yeah.
Especially in rock and roll and its, you know, subsidiaries.
Yeah. You said you were saying something about the guitars in this song, and I agree. I mean, the guitars are really the bendy, very bendy guitars. Yeah. And just a, you know, 2.5 minute song that it didn't feel like it was too short. It felt like it was exactly the right length it needed to be. You know. So yeah.
I mean, I would have liked another verse, but it's good.
but it still works, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't really have much else to say about it unless you want.
Yeah, I thought that they were like going to go into something else, but no, the song was sort of like it ended kind of a little bit quicker than I expected it to.
Mm.
But, you know, I still really liked it.
Fair enough. Yeah. Yeah. All right, so the next song is called Hallowed Be My Name.
Another short one.
That's a good Halloween song, I think.
Yeah, it is a pretty good one. Well, there's a few good ones on here that make good, but this, of course, is Alice Cooper.
Yeah. You could pretty much play his whole discography at a Halloween party and get away
probably
with it.
Yeah, that song had a real... It honestly sounds like a late 60s thing to me.
Yeah.
I wonder if
a little more psychedelic.
Yeah, quite a bit, actually.
But that's kind of where he started. I mean, he started... his first few bands were like garage rock bands. I mean, he's from Michigan, so you know, Detroit garage rock scene was, you know, basically in his backyard. So
yeah, he's hanging around with like oh my god, names.
Like Stooges.
Yeah, the Stooges and Bob Seger.
Yeah. Although I don't know if he's actually No, I'm completely wrong. For some reason, I thought he was from Michigan. He's from Phoenix, Arizona.
Oh.
So, I don't know where I got the idea that he was from Michigan from.
Hmm. But I'm sure he was around that scene, though.
I think so.
Because he really does, like, he picked up a lot of, like, sounds of that scene in a lot of ways. He sounds more of that ilk than... of a, like, I don't know, an LA scene or something like that. Mm-hmm. Although the theatrics is definitely an LA thing for sure. Yeah. No, that's,
yeah, he, I'm just reading his Wikipedia here. He's from, he's from, Phoenix, Arizona, but in the early days of the band moved to Pontiac, Michigan.
Yeah, makes sense. There you go.
So he, I guess he was aware of the Detroit scene.
Of course.
And so, you know, he moved out there to kind of be a part of it. Mm. So that makes total sense. He's probably, I know for a fact, or not for a fact, but I get the impression that he's like us, where he's like a total music geek, and he would have been aware of the Detroit scene, even if it wasn't popular, you know, isn't in his high school, he would have been.
Yeah,
he would have been hip to the scene, I guess. Yeah,
he was. Yeah, and I was gonna say, well, he's more like us than you realize. I know he's a car guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
talking about the cars he's like, I've got a magazine around somewhere where he's actually talking about the cars he used to own.
Yeah,
and it's a car mag. I was thinking about how he was more in line with, like, the Detroit scene than, say, the LA scene, but I did notice, like, this song in particular sounds a lot like the Music Machine, and mm-hmm. they were an LA band.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's, you know, there's cross-sections.
But. Yeah. But I don't know if Phoenix, Arizona is, I don't know how close it is to LA.
Well, it's closer to LA than Michigan.
Fair enough, yeah.
So,
I'm not that up on American geography. I don't really. I have a vague idea of where these places are, but I don't really know the proximity to.
I mean, Arizona's like right smack dab next to California, so.
Yeah, I think it is.
It's right below Utah.
Yeah, because there's that point. I've seen it in a movie or something where it's where four states cross over. And mm-hmm. you can hop from state to state to state.
Right.
Like, there's, like, Utah, Colorado, Arizona, and Nevada, I think, or something. And I know Nevada's right next to California, so it's all in the same western part of the...
Nevada. Maybe it's Nevada that I was thinking of. Yeah, I think maybe Arizona's a little bit before. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I can't really remember. I know it's in those desert states, so...
Yeah. So... I know, I think the Grand Canyon is in Arizona.
Yes.
Anyway, that's your geography lesson for the day.
We're not geography teachers.
No. I'm not a geographist.
No. I've got a pretty good idea of where things are located, though it's not always 100%.
I always have a vague idea of where things are. Anyway, moving on to the next one. The next song is called Second Coming. Time is getting closer. Ready to turn a poster. Let it go and expose us. Corners brought the sign. So that's that was cool. I like the end with the like kind of the military drums.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, it's another one that's like in minor keys and stuff mm-hmm. like that. Yeah, it's pretty cool. I don't know what else to really say about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, I wouldn't say it's a throwaway song, but it's just kind of, you know, it feels like it's part of the album.
Yeah.
You know, it's just kind of... It feels maybe a bit like a transition song, and maybe it's just because it leads into the next one.
Yeah, so. I think it is a transition song. It's another really short one.
Yeah.
Well, it was about it's 3 minutes, but still it's fairly short.
Yeah. I think it's probably because the last minute was that instrumental part.
Yeah.
That's why it felt so short. So.
Yeah, with the piano going. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I don't really have much else to say about it. And but I'm curious about how it transitions to the next one. Let's listen to the next one.
Right.
It's called The Ballad of Dwight Frye. So it seems like the last three songs are sort of connected to each other,
mm-hmm.
almost in the sort of like the medley on Abbey Road kind of thing. So it's kind of, I guess it's like a three act play or something like that. This was definitely more, definitely more of a theatrical thing, kind of like the Black Juju song.
Yeah.
Similar in structure and things like that.
I noticed a lot of like Lou Reed or Velvet Underground influence in that one.
Yeah.
And of course, a little more Music Machine as well. It mm-hmm. just sort of leaked through. Yeah, I'm really liking his references for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I'd only heard the stuff that hit the radio, but yeah, it's good to sit down and listen to a full album of his because there's a lot of really cool stuff going on. It's they're a very cool band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I actually want to take a minute to talk about the band because, I mean, they're playing really well here, and I'm curious at what point they broke up and it became Alice Cooper, the solo artist. Oh, I think they're well into the 70s.
Hmm.
Yeah. I think it wasn't until 75 that they kind of disbanded and on Welcome to My Nightmare.
That's a good half decade of albums and material. Yeah. And a lot of hits came from that era.
Yeah. So
it's not like much changed as far as like marketing or recognizability changed. I think that was entirely his point. It's just like, well, if I take the name Alice Cooper, I can continue on with this thing that I'm having a blast doing.
Yeah.
And he has.
Yeah. And he was always like the face of the band. Like he was, you know, so it makes sense.
Exactly.
I just wonder if there was any... I don't know much about the band or anything. I'm just curious if there was any legal ramifications from doing that or not.
Probably not.
Yeah.
It might not have even been like a dispute or something like that. It's possible they just went their own ways.
Yeah.
It's happened sometimes. Well, it happens quite a bit.
Yeah. I know it happened with, an example is Matt Mays and El right. Torpedo. I think one guy owned the name El Torpedo and he left, so it just became Matt Mays.
Right.
But it was still basically the same band right. that he plays with all the time. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Band politics.
It's the legalities and copyright issues and intellectual property,
yeah,
stuff like that. It always messes things up in a lot of ways. People try their best to navigate it to, you know, keep it fun, but it really doesn't make things fun.
No. No, it's, it's like we've said before, it's one of the hardest things in the world. It's one of the hardest things to get a band together. It's almost impossible to keep a band together.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yep. Indeed.
Yep. On that happy note, we've arrived at the final song on the album, and it's called Sun Arise.
Filling up the hollow, sunrise, filling up the hollow, bringing back the warmth to the ground.
cool. I actually like that. It probably works a little better live as a chant to get the audience right. going.
Yeah.
But I think I like it because it ends the album on a more positive note, I guess. It just has that uplifting kind of slow build and right. that I like, you know.
But it still sounds like it still like sonically fits the rest of the album.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that I was going to mention as I was listening to that song is each song on this album kind of has its own thing going on, but yeah. none of the songs feel out of place.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like each song is very distinct from the next, but they all fit together.
Right.
Which is, it's a hard balance to do because obviously if you're putting an album, especially an album like this, where I wouldn't say this is a concept album, but it has, I guess, a loose theme to it. Mm-hmm. You don't want to run into the issue of having every song sound the same, but you also don't want the songs to be so different from each other that it doesn't make sense or it doesn't right. work. And I think this album pulls it off really well of just striking that balance between the two.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Weird noises again. Anyway, when you can like play that balance with having the it's good not to sound like you still need to sound like your band. If you come out sounding like completely different bands, I mean, I guess, I don't know, could someone make that work? I mean, it would be interesting to watch a band sort of transform into completely different bands, but yeah, sonically it doesn't fit. It comes off as just sort of confusing. Yeah, it's not something a lot of bands can do. Sloan was one of those bands that could do that. Mm-hmm. They do that really well, where the sound, they always sound like them, but the songs are always so very distinct. You can usually figure out which one of them wrote it.
Yeah.
I mean, not only because one of them singing it, but just the styles, like each one of them has like a very different approach to writing and stuff like mm-hmm. that. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the advantage that band has that most bands don't is they have four very distinct and really good songwriters.
Right.
Most bands don't have
multi-instrumentalists.
Yeah. This is a totally a tangent, but I saw a comment once about how Andrew Scott, someone said, well, he doesn't, like, when a drummer plays, like Dave Grohl, when he plays guitar, right. he kind of approaches the guitar very rhythmically, and I think it's because he's has a lot of experience as a drummer.
Right.
And when he approaches the guitar, I've seen him talk about it. He approaches the guitar like the drummer, like the lower strings are like the kicks and like a kick drum. And then the higher strings are like the snares and the cymbals. And I saw a comment about how Andrew Scott from Sloan doesn't play guitar like a drummer. And I thought about it and I pointed out, well, no, he doesn't play guitar like a drummer, but he kind of plays the drums like a guitar player.
Because
he kind of has that Keith Moon kind of spontaneous
right.
thing going on with him. You know, especially if you listen to the drums on Money City Maniacs, he's like doing all kinds of stuff
yeah,
like Keith Moon.
He's playing all of his drums on kind of like a chord in a lot
yeah.
of ways.
Yeah, so he's kind of approaching the drums like a guitar player.
Which is a really interesting way to think about it. Yeah. I mean, I know we just way got off our tangent here.
Yeah. I may or may not edit that out because
we're talking about Alice Cooper and suddenly, they're talking about Sloan.
Canadian alternative rock.
But we do that. We do that yeah. all the time. Yeah. Honestly, it's not a big deal.
Yeah. But, anyway, this album, I really like this album. I hadn't heard the only song I heard from this before was 18. I really enjoyed this album.
Yeah, this one fits right in with the stuff that it just fits in with like my playlist stuff. It's just, it slots right in. It's got that psychedelic edge to it. It's got that proto-metal, proto-punk elements to it. It's just, it slots right into the stuff that's already, like, in my rotation. I should definitely pay more attention to some of the Alice Cooper stuff, especially the early stuff. I'm really interested in those two earlier albums, because sounds like they actually did come out of the 60s.
So one of just aside, one of the interesting things about the first two albums, I think, I could be totally wrong, let me just check to make sure, I think they were produced by Frank Zappa. I know he's So Frank Zappa signed Alice Cooper to his record label.
Okay, gotcha. There you go.
Right. Yeah. So, but no, he didn't produce them. But no, there is a there's definitely a connection to Frank Zappa there. Frank Zappa. I mean, you know, there's another guy that's maybe not as theatrical, but he definitely has the same, I guess, sense of humor in his songwriting as Alice Cooper. So I think they probably got along really well.
Yeah, so, probably.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Well, I don't have anything else to say about this album other than I'm glad I listened to it.
Right.
Any final thoughts?
Not really. Alice Cooper, two thumbs up. Sure.
Two thumbs up. Yeah. We don't have a rating system.
No, we don't really.
I don't think we need one. No. All right. Well, thank you so much for listening. If you made it this far, you can check us out at polyphonicpress.com and drop us a line at polyphonicpressmusic@gmail.com. And if you want to help out and support the show, you can do that at buymeacoffee.com/polyphonicpress. And that's about it. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
And I'm John Van Dyke.
Take it easy.
You have been listening to Polyphonic Press. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Polyphonic Press. Check out the website, polyphonicpress.com. Feel free to drop us a line at polyphonicpressmusic@gmail.com. And finally, you can support the show by heading over to patreon.com/polyphonicpress.